morning, everyone. This is Dennis, mailbox 3030. I'll be reading the health report for today, and today is September 25th. So there's a lot of diseases that people, or illnesses people have, and they can't find a cure for it. So I thought we'd delve into the body-mind relationship today. It says, millions of women who look perfectly healthy on the outside are grappling with chronic conditions that make normal life anything but. This is what it's really like to have an invisible disease. It's rare to see Carol Head, a longtime nonprofit executive, without her signature accessory, a sleek black Fitbit. Like many health-conscious, goal-oriented women, Head relies on the tracker to count her steps, but it's not because she's trying to get more exercise. She wants to make sure she doesn't get too much of it. I keep my steps under 4,000 a day, she said. I'd love to walk the 5 blocks to Starbucks on a beautiful afternoon, but if I exceed my threshold, I have a hard time functioning at work the rest of the day. Head, 64, is one of an estimated 2.5 million Americans with myalgic encephalomyelitis, commonly known as a chronic fatigue syndrome. And she's grateful she can work at all. Some of the women she's met in her role as president and CEO of Solve, ME/CFS initiative, have been housebound for months or even years at a time, in part because of their vague, complex, and frustrating symptoms have been downplayed, misdiagnosed, and ignored by medical providers. ME/CFS is one of a dozen or more invisible diseases such as Lyme disease, lupus, fibromyalgia, and Crohn's disease that tend to strike women more frequently than men. There's no strict medical definition, but invisible illnesses are diseases that affect a woman's ability to conduct her life as she'd like to, but you can't see, explains Head. People with these conditions often seem fine, and that creates all sorts of additional challenges, like being harassed for using a handicapped parking space or struggling to make friends understand the effort it takes to simply go out to dinner. Taylor Brune, a 27-year-old medical assistant and pre-med student who has type 1 diabetes, Lyme disease, and the autoimmune system Hashimoto's thyroiditis, says people tell her that she's too young or looks too healthy to be truly sick. These misconceptions are disheartening because not only are we suffering from the symptoms, but we also then have to defend ourselves to try to prove to others that we are ill, and that only creates more stress and sickness. So there are medical mysteries. Unfortunately, many invisible diseases cannot be diagnosed by a simple blood test or tissue biopsy. And many have subjective symptoms like fatigue, headaches, and body pain that could be associated with hundreds of different medical conditions. In lupus, for example, diagnosis is a challenge because there are so many ways it can manifest, and the symptoms may not necessarily happen at all at once, says Tara Tedeschi, a rheumatologist at Brigham and Women's. Sometimes women see multiple conditions over many years before someone starts to put the clues together. That was certainly the case of Taylor Ledden, a public relations associate who waited 10 years to find out what was going on with her health. I saw my general physician at first and was diagnosed with depression, she recalls. That wasn't necessarily incorrect. It just wasn't the whole story. When I began having more intense pain and fatigue, exhaustion, and coupled with exhaustion from a little bit of exertion, I went back and he ran a few tests and referred me to a rheumatologist. After 3 doctors and a nurse practitioner, pain testing, and multiple in-depth talks about symptoms, Ledden was finally diagnosed with fibromyalgia, a chronic progressive inflammatory disease. The reality that many invisible disease illnesses disproportionately affect women creates another unique obstacle for patients: differences in the way the female and male patients are treated. One study from the hospital at the University of Pennsylvania found that women had to wait longer to be given pain meds in the ER than men. In a seminal paper published in the Journal of Law, Medicine, and Ethics, 2 researchers from University of Maryland, one a lawyer and the other a PhD-level nurse, concluded that women are often portrayed as hysterical or emotional in medical circles, and that doctors find women to have more psychosomatic illnesses and complaints due to emotional factors than men. Take Bruni, for instance, who went to see her doctor almost a dozen times over a few months complaining of fatigue, moodiness, and unexplained weight loss. She brushed me off and ultimately sent me to a psychiatrist for a Zoloft prescription. What was really happening was that my pancreas wasn't working. I ended up in intensive care with life-threatening diabetic ketoacidosis. It took a literal brush with death for Bruni to be taken seriously and correctly diagnosed. Even Head, who makes her living as a professional advocate for invisible illness organizations, still has to contend with ignorance, judgment, and stigma sometimes. 3 years ago, I chose a new primary care doctor. It was my first appointment, and she was taking a full medical history. Toward the end of the appointment, I told her that although I was in fairly good health in other ways, the dominant medical issue of my life was myalgic encephalomyelitis. She literally rolled her eyes and said, "I don't believe in that." Head did her best to calmly offer the doctor a few educational references, then found herself a new physician. Every patient and doctor that we spoke to said that women with invisible illnesses must be their own advocates. If something seems off, don't ignore it. Recording specifics in a diary is always a good idea, especially making note of the location of the pain if you have it. Duration of symptoms and the circumstances around which they occur is important too. For example, if your symptoms flare up when you also have an infection like a cold or UTI, that's useful information, she explains. As you start to see doctors compile your records, request copies, not just of the clinical notes for your appointments, but also lab results and imaging studies. When you're going to see a specialist, send them to the doctor ahead of time. Diagnosing an invisible illness can be like piecing together a complicated puzzle. The more pieces you have, the more complete the picture. Getting there might take second opinions. If someone dismisses you, find another doctor to examine and run the labs you need to get answers. To track down good local physicians, Ledin suggests checking out message boards and forums. See if there are people in your area dealing with the same symptoms, as if they have a doctor that they would recommend you talk with. You can use the internet to gather facts too. Sure, there is bad health advice online, but there is also solid data. Focus on content published by large medical schools and research universities, such as Mayo Clinic and Cleveland Clinic, and government health sites like the CDC.gov or NIH.gov, and nonprofit advocacy sites. When it comes time to tell coworkers and family and friends about your health, you have those conversations face to face. If symptoms like fatigue, pain, weakness, sleep disturbance, and others are slowing you down, the people around you may judge you as unreliable, says Head. You can't control what they think, but you can educate them and offer to answer their questions. Say, "Let's sit down. I need a half an hour to talk through what is happening with me because I want you to understand." Keeping your struggles secret is tempting, says Head, but speaking your truth is freeing and can ultimately help with your relationships. It is also worth connecting with people who understand your experience without any explanation. Find online communities around your condition. Just interacting with others who have what you have can make you feel even more empowered and helpful. So, there you go. Here we have a matter of heart. It says, high blood pressure can seem a little mysterious. There are usually no obvious causes or symptoms, but the risks are clear. Here's why it happens, and even otherwise to otherwise healthy people, and how to protect against it. Your heart has a big job to do. In order to deliver oxygen from head to toe, it must carefully regulate the force it uses to push blood through your arteries. That force, which is also known as blood pressure, fluctuates throughout your lifetime and even throughout the day. But when the pressure becomes higher than normal and stays that way for too long, the extra strain can damage your artery walls. Picture a rushing river eroding the banks or a blown-up balloon stretched too thin. 1 in 3 American adults has chronically high blood pressure or hypertension. Only about half of are being effectively treated, and many don't know that they have the condition until something serious, like a heart attack or stroke, happens without warning. The phrase silent killers may sound ominous, but it's really pretty accurate, says Florian Rader, a assistant professor of medicine at Cedars-Sinai. To make matters worse, another 1/3 of adults are at risk of developmental hypertension in the near future. The news isn't all scary, though. The silver lining is that high blood pressure can be managed by even avoided altogether. Blood pressure is measured in millimeters of mercury, or mmHg, and there are two numbers to monitor. The top one indicates systolic pressure, measured while the heart is pumping blood out into the vessels. The bottom number is the diastolic pressure, measured while the heart is relaxing between the beats and blood is flowing back in. It used to be that blood pressure wasn't considered high until it reached 140 over 90, but that definition has shifted in recent years. Now the American Heart Association says that hypertension starts when a systolic pressure reaches 130 and a diastolic pressure hits 80. People whose systolic pressure is between 120 and 129 with a diastolic below 130 have pre-hypertension. This means they're likely to develop a full-blown hypertension unless they make changes and get their numbers under control. For most people with elevated blood pressure, there isn't one single reason. Aging certainly plays a role. As we get older, our arteries stiffen and our systolic pressure tends to rise. Your genetics, including your race, can affect your risk too. African Americans are up to 2 times more likely to develop hypertension by age 55 compared with Caucasians. And having a parent or two with high blood pressure also significantly boosts your odds of developing. About 1/3 of hypertension risk is tied to DNA, says Mark Benson, Preventive Cardiovascular Disease at Beth Israel. Luckily, this means the other 2/3 is probably due to factors you have some control over. Those factors include the usual suspects: diet, exercise, obesity, smoking, and drinking. But sometimes even the fittest people develop the condition. We actually know surprisingly little about why some people have poorly controlled blood pressures and others don't. That's why you need to know your risk factors and your numbers, because the numbers really can be unpredictable. Keeping your numbers in a healthy range is so important because high blood pressure forces the heart to work harder and less effectively. It can also lead to buildup of plaque along weakened artery walls, increase your risk of blood clots, and damage kidneys and other organs. Doctors used to think this type of damage only began after hypertension went untreated for decades, but recent research suggests it may start earlier. A study published in 2019 in the journal Neurology, for example, found that people as young as 19 to 40 with just a slightly elevated blood pressure already had reduced brain volume, a possible precursor to stroke or cognitive decline, compared to those in the normal blood pressure range. Doctors warn that high blood pressure is the number one modifiable risk factor for cardiovascular disease, which itself is the number one killer of Americans. But the key word here is modifiable. What's encouraging is that we also know for sure that treating hypertension can significantly decrease those risks. So how do you lower the pressure? The first step is always to try to improve lifestyle. And slashing your sodium intake may be a good place to start. For many people, Dr. Benson says, reducing salt to 1,500 milligrams a day or less can knock 3 to 5 points off the systolic pressure in as little as 3 months. High sodium levels make it tough for the kidneys to filter water out of the blood, which leads to excess extra fluid and high blood pressure. Adding more heart-healthy fruits and vegetables, getting regular exercise, and losing weight can help too. You can expect to reduce your blood pressure by about a point for every 2 pounds you lose. Dr. Benson recommends following a DASH, Dietary Approaches to Stop Hypertension diet, and aiming for 150 minutes of moderate exercise a week. Every step counts, even the small ones, and they really do add up to reduce your risk. If lifestyle changes aren't enough, however, you may need to take medication. Today's drugs are more effective than ever before, says Dr. Mann, and there are plenty to choose from. Not all drugs work the same for all people, but we usually find one that controls hypertension effectively without causing side effects. So just another thing to add to your annual checklist for bodily functions is to be able to do it. someone has chosen to mess up the magazines here a little bit today, so I apologize for the incessant page turning with this. There's an article called Revving Your Engine. Slow, fast, important, irrelevant, we break down the facts of the ultimate weight loss buzzword, metabolism. Your metabolism is a complex system. It determines how quickly and efficiently your body burns calories and how much you can eat in a day without putting on weight. Scientists are still gaining a new insight into the factors that make your metabolism run, but they know for sure that becoming a healthier, stronger woman can fire yours up, prolong good health, improving mood, slowing the effects of aging, and maybe even helping you lose some weight along the way. Experts share the latest findings, plus what you need to know to make all that good stuff happen. First is, some parts of your metabolism are beyond your control. Although many of us talk about metabolism as if it's a single bodily process, there are actually three types, which each of which expends energy at a different rate. Your resting metabolic rate determines the amount of energy your organs use to stay functional when you're sitting around. It makes up the largest piece of the metabolism pie, about 60 to 75% on a regular workday with minimal activity, and there's very little you can do about it. In fact, contrary to what many people have heard, thin people don't have faster resting metabolic rates. The bigger you are, regardless of whether that weight comes from muscle or fat, the higher your resting metabolic rate will be. Your active metabolism, which accounts for about 10 to 15% of the calories you burn in a day, dictates the energy you use up when you're walking, running exercises, and even fidgeting. This is the type you may have more control over to some degree, since the more you move, the more calories you burn. Finally, there's a diet-induced thermogenesis, the energy your body uses to consume and digest food. Yep, you get a bonus burn, 8 to 12% of your daily calories for eating. Your muscles are in charge. A pound of muscle burns 7 to 10 calories a day, while a pound of fat burns just 2 to 3. We all lose muscle as we age, starting in our 20s, and as it vanishes, so does our calorie-burning power. By your 70s, your resting metabolism may be 15% slower than it was in your 20s. That's 15% less food you can eat without gaining weight. While building new muscle can help counteract this trend, it's even more important to gauge the muscle you already have. Every time you challenge your muscles by strength training, they go through a breakdown and repair process or remodeling. This means you burn calories while working out and continue to burn them after you put the weights away. Keep up the practice and you'll increase the speed of your resting metabolism if your muscles stay about the same size. If you're not already on the protein bandwagon, get on board. Although the USDA suggests consuming 5 ounces of protein source per day as part of a 1,600-calorie diet, many experts say that recommendation is conservative and even on the low side. Your body needs amino acids, the building blocks of protein, to stay functional. If you don't eat a diet rich in them, your body's forced to tap your muscles, which have a great reservoir. When you lose valuable muscle, your resting metabolism pays the price. And then it says dieting. Any weight loss diet, even one that seems sensible, will leave your metabolism slower than it was when you weighed more. That's partly because each time you shed pounds, you lose fat and muscle. But when you ditch your diet and regain weight, the fat pounds come back as fat. And since smaller people have slower metabolisms than bigger people, you'll have to eat even fewer calories than you did at the start of your diet to maintain your new weight. More annoying news, the part of your brain that manages your metabolism cares little about whether you ever fit back into your favorite genes and cares very much about whether you have the energy you need to survive. Try to cheat your body out of the calories it's come to rely on, and it will immediately start robbing your muscles of fuel and directing that energy to your vital organs, causing your metabolism to dip lower. And finally, it says, your metabolism never sleeps. A single night of sleep deprivation can alter your metabolism and trigger weight gain, according to the recent research from Uppsala Institute in Sweden. Lack of sleep tends to slow people's metabolism, in part because that's when your body repairs itself while it burns calories. So there is our health report for today. As always, if there's anything I can do, if there's any particular topic you'd like me to discuss, leave me a message at 3030. I'm happy to do the research on these things because, once again, this is your forum, not mine. So I wish you a happy, healthy day. Stay well, and we'll talk to you soon. Take care.